Mississippi sitting in here complaining about all the work he had to do the other day. What the hell you call it? Deception? Do what kind of match? The what match?
It's called a bitch. It was a decoction.
Decoction. Okay, you're going to have to explain that one. I know there's probably two, three of them out there that have no idea what that is.
I'm a little, I'm almost too tired to explain it. I did it today. It wasn't the other day. It was today.
Oh, today. Oh, shit.
Yeah, I got the airlock on an hour and a half before the show started. An hour and a half ago, I started this morning early. It was 8 hours, a little over 8 hours, from the time I actually started brewing. That's not counting the time that I spent crushing grains and all that stuff.
Well, you're a chicken farmer. You ought to be used to the hard work, right?
Yeah, my wife takes care of that.
Oh, well. Well,
no, I wanted to make a box. And, you know, if I was going to do it, I said, I'm going to do it one time, traditional, the way it's supposed to be. And that involves pulling out, you know, you hit a acid rest with your mash, and then you pull out the thick part and you boil it for 30 minutes. You put it back into your protein rest, and let it sit for a while, pull out the thick part again, boil it for 30 minutes. And this goes on and on all day. And eventually you get to your 90 minute boil. So by the time I got the wort chilled and aerated and put my aeration stone in it, got ready and finally got to pitch the yeast, it was well over 8 hours.
Jeez. Well, for a guy that just drinks beer, and did we start something here or what? I mean, now you're brewing beer.
No, I'm doing this as a base for a braggot.
There you go. Yeah. So. Well, welcome to the show, the Mead House, tonight on a Tuesday night. I have no idea where we're at. I do know that we're on a 6-2 schedule, and I think we're off on February 7th for a couple of weeks, and we're back on the 28th. So you folks out there in Mead Houseville, you want to keep that in mind. Let's go to Jeff with the Facebook. Did you find anything interesting on Facebook tonight?
I've got a couple of them, actually. Let's see here. So the first one I wanted to throw out was for a fellow beekeeper. Travis Brandt posted this today about one of his hives that he lost. Couldn't survive the winter, too cold. And it says he's going to have to harvest this honey early. It says he's got some – it's a really pungent sage – sage flower honey, and thinks it'll be perfect for this recipe that he's got planned for it. It's gonna be it's what he calls the Hansy Monk version 2. It has an overwhelming amount of black currant, some sage honey, and he's using the Safe Brews Abbey yeast. So sounded really good. Sorry to hear about your bees there, Travis, but you know, glad to hear that you've got some plans for that honey. And then the next one was actually, I just thought it was an interesting one because it actually comes along kind of towards my topic of the evening. Thomas Ray Dillon Jr. on the Mead Facebook group says that he's looking at making a cinnamon metheglin, a cinnamon mead, kind of in the style of a Fireball whiskey, and wanted to reach out for tips and stuff to the Facebook community. And you know, we're talking a little bit tonight on my side about making tinctures, which is a really good way to add pretty much any herbicide to mead. Have you guys had any experience with cinnamon?
Not like that. Nothing more than just, you know, adding a couple of cinnamon sticks in a cider. But...
Yeah, I've done two that I've added cinnamon sticks to the secondary. One of them was with that, what did we call that? The spice rack mead that I was telling you guys about that needed, that needs another 38 years to age out.
Yeah.
And then another one right now, which is cider, which is going with just a couple of, cinnamon and vanilla and a little oak. And that one is still in secondary, and I've been checking that one. But I'm excited to hear your tincture segment tonight, because that's something I've been trying to work on a little bit and take some of the guesswork and risk out of just dropping whole spices into the secondary.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's there is part of me that really likes the idea of tinctures, because it does give you a nice level of control. There's another part of me that says, you know, I just like to soak it, let it kind of draw out all those flavors itself. But no, it's definitely a good technique to have in your toolbox.
It doesn't look like we're going to be a whole lot of help to him. and I'm not I get the Fireball whiskey. Now my wife loves the Jack Daniel's version of the Fireball whiskeys, but I am not a fan. I'm not a fan of flavored drinks like that. Any kind of flavored drink. But
he could always try some Fireball candy. Drop a few Red Hot.
Ooh. Yeah, there you go. That's
an interesting idea right there.
Yeah. Well, good stuff. Anything else, Jeff?
That's all I got tonight.
Cool. Hey, again, welcome to the Mead House. You can catch the replays at the Mead House, themeadhouse.com. You can also get them on iTunes, Stitcher Radio. Just about any place out there. Podcastpedia is another place that you can pick them up at. And, of course, yeah, we are live every Tuesday night. Ryan Richardson in the house, Aaron Martin, Mississippi, Chris Spencer along for the ride. And you just heard Jeff Schaus give us our Facebook rundown. My name is J.D. Webb. We're going to cut right into some good stuff here tonight. Ryan's going to talk to us about nuts. Not his nuts, just other kind of nuts. We're going to have a discussion about tinctures, as Jeff alluded to. Chris is going to tell us what's on his brew list for 2017. But, guys, first, let's do this. I skipped right over last week. What are we drinking tonight, Aaron?
So tonight in the glass, I've got a chocolate peanut butter porter. This is a brew from Horny Goat Brewing in Milwaukee, and really good this time of year. It's got a really strong peanut butter flavor. I find, at least for my tastes, a lot of the chocolate peanut butter porters that you find out there, you really pick up the chocolate notes, but maybe not so much of the peanut butter. And this is just really well balanced. You get both of those flavors. So definitely a good wintertime sipper here.
Good deal. I've been on this orange thing, and I'll talk about that a little bit later on too. But I picked up this. It's called the Dude's Blood Orange. It's supposed to be an amber. It says, that's all it says. The Dude's Blood Orange Amber Ale with natural flavors. But it's a pretty dark beer for an amber. Now this is, it's supposed to be made with blood oranges. I'm not sure that I'm getting the blood orange. I mean, it's a good tasting beer, but maybe I'm picking it up right at the very end, like almost an aftertaste. But I'm getting a little bit of a chocolate note. Now, chocolate and oranges sounds really good to me. And I think that may go well with what I've got planned that we'll talk about a little bit later on. But the dudes, blood orange, amber, that's what I'm drinking tonight. Jeff, what's in your glass, bud?
Oh, so tonight I've got something from a...
Losing
the microphone here.
Oh, there it is.
I got something from a newer microbrewery in town here. It's called Monk and Honey, and by Torn Label Brewing Company. It's, I'm not sure if you would call it a braggot or just a Belgian-style beer with some honey in it, but it's just that. I think it's a Belgian triple with a little bit of honey added to it. You taste the paler, the Belgian triple style beer a lot more than you taste the honey in it, but it's a nice smooth drink. It's got a little bit more of the hoppy flavor than I come to expect out of a triple, but it's not terrible at all. Definitely very palatable.
Cool. Excellent. Chris, what are you drinking, bud?
Got a bottle of the Graf. Decided to try it.
Yeah, how's that going?
It's coming right along. It gets better every time now. So,
yeah,
I think the thing to do with this is to sit it back for another month and then pound the crap out of it.
Well, I haven't, since you and I talked the last time, I haven't taken a sip, going to back off, wait. And if you think it needs another month, I'm game.
I think one more month, just judging by how it's coming along, I think one more month and it's going to be ready to go.
Now, you didn't keg yours, you bottled yours. So you aged, you're aging in the bottle, right?
Yep. I bottle conditioned it. Yeah, okay. That was long about the time my keg went kaput. So,
yeah. I've got mine's in a keg in the keyser. So I'm wondering if that actually has an effect on the aging process. I suppose not, huh? Temperature wise?
Probably not, because this is really cool.
Yeah.
This is being kept in the cooler, so I don't think it matters. Well, I don't know if it matters. I don't think there'll be any difference between yours and mine.
Yeah. Ryan, what are you drinking tonight?
I am drinking one of Ricky's meads. I'm drinking the Old Wayfarer, which is the oak-aged amber mead.
Mm, yeah.
What did you guys think of that one, if you can remember?
Honestly, I think that one was my favorite.
Yeah, same here.
Now, did you guys drink that chilled or room temperature? Yeah. Or how were you drinking it?
Chilled.
Yeah, right. Chilled as well, yep.
I
think it was number three on my list.
I pulled it out of the refrigerator, and I really wasn't getting much character out of it. And I'm thinking here, as it warms, I might get a little bit more, you know. And I hope that some more comes through. I think it might have been a little too chilled to really give off all of its potential.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a good point. Ricky, if you're listening, send us some more so that we can try that.
Oh, my God. Okay. Hey, you know, guys, I want to mention this one beer, Mal. We didn't pick this up in a liquor store. We got this at, the wife wants me to believe it was like Whole Foods. I don't think it was Whole Foods. It was some other little specialty market somewhere, but I've got to look for it. This is a beer. She only bought one bottle of this stuff, little 12-ounce bottle. It's called Einstock. It's an Icelandic toasted porter. It's an import. And this is probably the absolute best porter beer that I have ever had and that she's ever had. And she's the porter drinker in the house. So if you can locate this stuff called Einstock, Einstock, Icelandic toasted porter. It's got kind of a black label with a powder blue looking Viking dude with horns on the label. And it's white and kind of a powder blue printing on the label. Einstock, if you can find it. This stuff is outrageous. Really, really good. And I've got to go back and see if I can find some more. You know, we're gonna start getting into some regular meads coming up. And you know, been thinking about, you know, what to do. I mean, we've kind of gone the Melomel route. And I think we need to kind of play with some other different flavors. I know we talked about piment. That's one that I would like to do in this session before we go on our hiatus. Maybe over the next couple of weeks we can get that covered. But tonight, I think it was Mississippi. Weren't you the one telling me that you were doing something with some not macadamia? What the hell were they?
Pecans.
You're going to work up something with some pecans in it. We'll save that discussion for a little bit later on in the show. But I've also thought about doing something with coffee and macadamia nuts. So once in a while, I'll drop just one macadamia nut into my coffee grinder with my coffee and grind it up with the coffee beans. And I love that nuttiness that macadamia nuts give off. But Ryan, working with nuts. I mean, we're talking walnuts, pecans, all just some kind of nuts.
Yeah. You know, I've worked with a few different nuts. They've all
not the ones seated at the table here, right?
Right. I was gonna say that they've always been nuts that I've owned, so I've always worked with my nuts. But the two types of nuts that I've worked with have been almonds and walnuts, and I've used them in a couple of different batches here. One of them was I was doing a bochet, and I wanted to make it a kind of like a banana bread bochet. So I added, you know, bananas and walnuts, you know, to the caramelized honey to make my bochet. You know, as I was doing some reading and doing some experimenting, there's two things that I think you want to be concerned or cautious about with nuts. And the first one is nuts are oily. There's yeah. a lot of oils in them, and you want to be careful about that. And then secondly is that the skins on the nuts can give off a lot of bitterness. There's a lot of source of tannin, I suppose, you know, and it's, you know, can be very, very bitter. I think that the both of those can be solved in a couple of ways. The first way that I've done it, actually, I'll tell you this. I don't know if you've ever tried to skin almonds, but it, as Chris said earlier, it's a bitch, you know, trying to skin almonds. And it's even worse if you're trying to skin a walnut. And
how do you skin a walnut?
Yeah, there's. I think what you try to do is you try to blanch it. You know, you go from boiling water to ice water, and it's supposed to just kind of fall off for the most part, and I've never been that lucky. But skinning almonds is tough enough. Skinning walnuts is almost impossible. Buying, you know, if you want to buy skinned almonds, you know, you start paying a premium if you want to do that, or And even some of those almond shreds, you know, don't necessarily have the skins off of them. So anyway, there's two different ways that I've used nuts, and I've got a preference, and I'll start with that. My preference is using them in the boil. And what I mean is, you know, you don't have to, I'm not telling you to boil your honey or anything else, but boil the nuts. Take a, whether it's a hot bag or a tea ball or whatever you're using. And, I guess, you know, rinse off your nuts first, make sure there's no dust on them or anything else. And then chop them up pretty good. They don't have to be tiny. You know, you're still putting them in a hot bag or a grain bag or, you know, a tea ball. And boil them. I've typically gone for about an hour on the boil. And what you're doing is you're pulling a lot of that flavor out. You're pulling really all that good stuff out of them. After that hour, you can pull that out. You know. Frankly, they're, you know, if you're cooking something, those are probably fine to make in cookies or bread or whatever you want to use, or toss them if you need to. But then strain that liquid, in case there was anything that came through it, into your carboy or bucket or whatever you're worried about. Now, when I've done this boil method like this, I've never had, a bunch of oil collect on the surface, even after things have been cooled or things like that. That's me, you know, you might want to check yourself if maybe you need to skim some of the oil that might be pulled out if you do a lot. I should also mention that 1 to 2 ounces per gallon, 1 to 2 ounces of nuts per gallon is about right, depending on the strength of flavor you're going for and the type of nut you're using. And then if you're going to mix that with other types of nuts, it could be, that's what I'd start with anyway. I'd start around 1 to 2 ounces. And then also any of that bitterness that gets pulled off, from the skins, in primary is going to dissipate. You're not going to necessarily have to worry about an overly bitter wine or mead or braggot or whatever you're making, you know, by boiling those skins. That's the preferred method. So, you know, let's just say we were going to make an almond mead and nothing else, you know, 1 gallon. I'd take 2 ounces of almonds that are kind of rinsed off, chop them up, throw them in a hot bag, boil. Maybe, you know, 3/4 of a gallon of water for an hour with those almonds in there. You know, pour that into a carboy or a bucket, you know, with 1 pound of honey. You know, again, we're making a session mead, right? You know, once it's at room warmer temperature, you know, you're just because you don't want to. I don't heat my honey, and you know that's. So when that cools down a little bit, you know, I'd put it in the bucket, put the honey in, stir it up, you know, do your nutrient, your yeast, and go from there. And that's really as simple as it is. That's the way that I prefer using nuts. The other way that you can do nuts that I've tried in the past was in secondary. Now in secondary, you know, this is where you want to be a little more careful, I think, with those skins. Those skins can bitter in a hurry. And then number two would be being conscious of the oil. So the only time I ever used nuts in secondary, it was almonds. I had taken the skins off of them. I had put them in the toaster oven to toast the almonds. Try to also get rid of some of the oil, and then put them in secondary, and I was trying to get a little bit of a toasty almondy flavor out of it. And you know, I was a little nervous about the quantity to do, so I probably did maybe an ounce for the gallon, maybe even a little bit less. And maybe I didn't leave it in long enough. You know, maybe it was me. Maybe it was the almonds. I don't know. But I did not get a real strong, strong almond flavor from it. Nothing like you'd get from a, you know, an amaretto or something like that, which is probably the third way that you could add nuts to your mead would be to make a tincture, is if you wanted to, take a 2-3 ounce, jar and put any size jar you want, I suppose, and fill it up mostly with chopped nuts, top it off with a high proof clear spirit and let it kind of steep away, for a while until you get this almond flavored liqueur or pecan or walnut or Brazil nut or whatever you want. And then add that, back a teaspoon or an ounce at a time until you get that desired flavor.
How much oil? I tried making an almond extract. I'll talk more about that when we get to Jeff. But how much oil? This is the one thing that I've been concerned about, and I know Chris might want to chime in on this as well with his pecan thing. But I mean, how much oil are we talking about? And how concerned should we be about it? When we're talking, I know walnuts have quite a bit of oil in them. I don't know. I would have guessed pecans probably do too, but.
And JD, if I could even just add to your question, it may be obvious to some of the listeners, and I think I understand, but what is the risk of having the oil as well?
Well, the risk of having the oil is that you could impede or you could restrict fermentation. You could those oil. I'm not the chemist here, but if those that oil mixed in there is going to do a couple things. It could hurt fermentation. And if it goes to the top of let's say you're in a carboy, and that oil separates out and that comes to the top, or I guess would be the worst case scenario, it's not going to let anything through. You're probably going to have a lot harder time getting any of that oxygen to kind of come up through that oil, any action in your airlock there. There's a possibility that the oil could turn rancid. There's a lot of things that you want to be, I think, careful of. Now, in the same time, hops have a lot of oil in them. Hops have a lot of oil in them. A lot of other things that you use have oil in them. I think a little bit of oil is not going to hurt anything. A little bit of oil is not going to be any kind of a problem. I mean and like I said, when I've done a couple ounces, 2 ounces to a gallon, I've never even seen a visible amount of oil collect where you'd want to use any kind of a separator or a skimmer or anything like that, in there. I mean, maybe if you're using a pound of, walnuts in a gallon or something, you definitely would see it, but at that ounce level, it is not a concern that I've ever had. In secondary, again, I think that you could, if you're at that maybe 1 ounce level per gallon, it's probably not a big deal. You're probably not going to hurt anything. I mean, people throw oily, citrus peels in secondary and have no issues with it. It's more of, I would say, a precaution on my part on why I toasted those almonds. And then I thought, oh, that'd probably be also a real nice flavor.
You mentioned yeast health. actually, the oils from nuts, which are like walnuts especially, is primarily monosaccharides, which we classify them. Most people talk about them as healthy fats, and they're actually a small amount of it is actually good for the yeast. They can assimilate that and use it for energy outside of the alcohol fermentation. So, you know, a few years back, the going thing was to add like a quarter or a half a teaspoon of extra virgin olive oil into the must. And I think there were even some beer brewers who were doing that several years back. So, of course, now we don't really need to because we've got Firmaid K and things like that that have fatty acids inside them that provide all that. But that used to be a going thing.
Well, there you go. A little bit is good. And
extra virgin olive oil.
Next
thing you know, I'll be dropping a Italian sausage and a Roma tomato in and calling it some kind of an Italian beer. So I don't know.
Well, yeah, there you go. There's a little bit, like I said, at that 1-2 ounce level, it's you're probably helping fermentation. That's a good thing. Like I said, I think that if you were trying to get carried away and you said, oh, I'm going to put a pound of walnuts in, and you had a visible separation of your oil to water, you probably.
Do we drop Ryan again?
Hello?
Hello, Ryan.
You guys got me?
Yeah, you just cut out there for a minute.
Oh, all I was saying was, yeah, like that's a little at that 1-2 ounce level of nuts per gallon, you are probably helping fermentation. You're probably helping that chug along. And like I was saying, if you decide you want to do a pound worth of walnuts and you start seeing visible separation between the water and the oil, you probably want to strain that off before you start mixing in your honey.
Well, I've heard of guys dropping a handful of pecans in beer and they're boil at right there at the end. So they can't be worried about it too much. I mean, now I don't know if I'm assuming that they would probably toast the pecans I don't know, Chris, if you can even talk further about this, but even toasting walnuts or pecans, is that really, are you really getting any oil out of it? I mean, it certainly it's going to make it leach, but the oil is still there. You mean you just can't cook the oil out of it?
Well, you can extract some. I think it was Jeff who said he had had one of the Lazy Magnolia pecan brown ales. Was that you?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I had I emailed them about that and to find out how they got such a good pecan flavor, and we ended up talking on the phone actually, and so. If you break it down to a 5 gallon batch, basically what they do is to toast the pecans for like at 350 for maybe 5 to 10 minutes, and then you put them in a brown paper bag or on paper towels or something absorb as much of the oil as you can. The guy I talked to, he suggested a brown paper bag. He said it would really soak up the oil. Then you crush them. You don't have to crush them into powder, but just roughly chop them. And so in the brown ale, what we came up with, they do a protein rest and then a sac rest. And he said you would want to put about 1 cup of crushed pecans in the mash for the first rest and 2 cups for the second rest, and that's basically what they do. Now, when I made my last order, with Northern Brewer, they sent me a caribou slobber kit. I guess because my order was so large, they gave me a free kit. And so I plan to do that. And I think what I'm going to do is just put 3 cups in with the steeping grains and try it with that, because it is nothing more than an American brown ale. Now the only other time that I've used pecans has been in that banana bread mead, and I toasted those the same way, patted them down with paper towels, but they just went in primary after I chopped them, and I have not tasted that yet, so I don't know how much of it came through, but I put about, I think I put 8 ounces in that 3-gallon batch.
I've been thinking about chopping up some. I've got this Irish stout here for the wife that I'm going to throw a little extra chocolate in, and I was thinking in some coffee, and was thinking about chucking a handful of chopped up macadamia nuts into the boil, and then adding the what's that?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Oh, that's all right. And I'm going to use that that caramelized honey that I did that in that crock pot deal I did here a few days back. I don't know how much oil. I mean, I love macadamia nuts, and I haven't paid that much attention to any kind of an oil content in a macadamia nut. But I figured I'd just, you know, like you say, Chris, toss them in the oven for, you know, 5 minutes at 350. Bring them out, chop them up, dry them off, and throw them in the mix.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do with this brown ale. I'm just going to try it and see. You did ask what were the downsides to having that oil. And the only other thing that I can think of, the two main ones is, like Ryan said, it can go rancid for one. But the other is that if you are making something that's going to be carbonated, it could affect head retention.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. Yeah. That's a good point. In fact, I'm making a note of it. You know, we need to hire a secretary. we need to get, I mean, my wife works at night, so I'm here home alone all the time during our show, but we need to con one of your wives into listening to the show and taking notes.
We need one of those women that's got the real sexy voice, who knows nothing about brewing or making mead or anything, and her only job is just to make little comments along and take notes.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, Ryan, thanks, man. That's another, I don't know about the rest of us, you know, nuts. I mean, and I like walnuts. I like pecans. I like just about any kind of nuts. I don't eat a lot of them. There's a lot of nuts that I'm not supposed to eat, as Mississippi well knows. But there's some that I can eat that are okay. But
pistachios are my favorite. But it's tough for me to try to picture a pistachio mead.
Yeah,
you know, I got fresh pistachios upstairs. I got pistachio gelato in the icebox, but I just can't picture a gelato or pistachio mead.
Pistachio mead. Yeah. Well, hey, let's work on that one. I mean, there you go. If we had our secretary here, just Barbara, write that down.
Maybe we should make it into the. You know, the unimaginable and possible mead. So I'll do, you know, watermelon and pistachio mead.
Well, you know, I mean, come on, guys. We've talked, how many times have we talked about this? I mean, this is, you know, what the hell can you do with mead? You can do anything you want. So maybe this is one of those things. This is one of those experiments. Ryan, since you brought it up, 1 gallon batch, throw one of your session meads together, drop a handful of pistachios in it, and see what happens.
You know? I'll put it on the list. We'll see how long it takes to get to.
I mean, what the hell?
It's funny that you mentioned pistachios, though, because one of the random concepts that I came up with that has, it's way down on my list, but it's on my list, is actually a, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the candy Turkish Delight.
Oh, yeah.
It's pistachio and roses, predominantly. Rose water flavoring.
Interesting.
And I thought that would make a really interesting, you know, maybe a semi-sweet mead, maybe a dry mead or off-dry. But that's one of those that's been floating around in the back of my mind that, you know, it would definitely need a good pistachio flavor to pull off correctly, along with a good source of that rose flavor, too.
Well, interesting that you you bring that up, Jeff, because what if you took those pistachios of Ryan's and made some kind of a tincture, or I mean, you know, what is that process all about?
So yeah, the tincture is definitely a way to approach getting flavors, especially out of herbs and spices. You could potentially do it with fruit, but it seems like a waste when it's frankly pretty easy to just throw it into the ferment and let the yeast have out some of those available sugars too. So the way that tincturing works essentially is pretty simple. It's kind of like a tea, except you're using alcohol instead of water. And the important thing to realize as to how this works is that a lot of the soluble flavors are going to fall into one of two categories. They're either a polar molecule or a nonpolar molecule, meaning they have, and this is going to sound strange, we're not used to thinking of it this way, but it has a small magnetic charge. Water is a polar soluble. So if the flavor compounds that are polar, it can leach those out of, you know, your herbs and spices, your tea leaves and things like that without problems. A lot of these flavor molecules are not polar, and water doesn't really isn't able to leach those out of the surrounding material nearly as easily. Alcohol, being not polar, actually is readily available to do it. And like we were talking about before, a lot of these things that are more woodsy or flavorful, they do tend to come in oil, because another non-polar solute is oil. So a lot of these are carried by oil when it comes to just the way that they're naturally consumed by us, either like the citrus oils in fruits, the kind of those monounsaturated fats and nuts that we were talking about being so good for you. Those are generally the vector that those get into our bodies in the first place. It's just kind of riding along on that fat or that oil. So when we're making a tincture, it's a pretty simple process. The way we're going to do this is to use an alcohol base. And generally, when I tried doing tinctures the first time, I tried to do the most concentrated alcohol I could get, which was Everclear. And I found out from that first batch, you really want an alcohol that's palatable, because, oh my God, it tasted like rocket fuel.
It is rocket fuel. What the hell?
Pretty much. Those Everclear, the distillers that make Everclear don't care if they're pulling fusels or any of those nasty alcohols that we're trying to avoid with temperature control. They just want the alcohol. And
yeah,
by God,
leftover turpentine. They just Everclear label on it. I mean, my God.
So the rule of thumb there is, you know, quality in gets quality out. You really want a nice neutral alcohol base. And from everything I've heard, from what I've tried here on my end, a general 80 to 100 proof vodka that doesn't have a lot of cider off flavors to it is really the vector of choice. And the amount of concentration is kind of something that you're going to have to dial in by your product. And the classic example of a tincture that has been floating around the internet for basically as long as I've seen Facebook as a thing is putting a few vanilla beans into the vodka to make your own vanilla extract. I think everybody on the internet has seen that one. And that's the idea. You put a set amount of material into that alcohol base and you just let it sit. Generally, the time to let a tincture sit is a couple weeks to a couple months, and then you would be able to separate the plant matter, the nuts or what have you that you're drawing that flavor out of from just that base liquid, and you get essentially that vodka with a lot of flavor concentrate right in there. At that point, it's a matter of drawing out a really small amount of liquid from your batch and kind of dialing in your flavor. So the approach that I usually use for flavoring things in this regard is take a half a pint to a pint and go like drop by drop to see around what flavor I want. Then I know, there's 2 pints in a quart, there's 4 quarts in a gallon. There's X number of gallons in my batch. I can do some pretty simple math to kind of scale it up. And I always dial it down a little bit because I find if I don't, I tend to overshoot instead of undershoot. That's generally the way you scale up to get the flavor that you're looking for in the concentration you're looking for in your batch.
Yeah. And there's not enough alcohol.
I learned early on that spices do not always scale up linearly. God, I'm tired. I can't talk. They don't always scale up exactly as you test them on a small batch.
Any particular kind of spice, Chris?
Well, vanilla and cinnamon are the ones that come to mind first. Maybe
as far as using a liquid, right?
Well, I've always put mine in secondary. I've never made a tincture, but I assume it would probably work the same way. But one cinnamon stick in a gallon seems to be okay. You put 5 cinnamon sticks in 5 gallons and you got just way too much cinnamon. So it doesn't always scale up.
Cinnamon also has a reputation, at least in from what I've heard. I've not worked a lot with it in particular, but it starts off kind of weak. And then after you've taken the cinnamon out and it's just kind of chilled for a while and rested or whatever, it has a reputation for coming back stronger too. Kind of in the same way that apples do.
Well, it develops that heat over time, that little burn that you get from a really strong cinnamon, that seems to develop over time. And but vanilla beans now, they seem to be just the opposite, which is why if I've got vanilla beans in secondary, I usually go a little bit further than I want it to be. Because the vanilla does seem to diminish, especially you start aging, a year and a half, 2 years.
Vanilla is such more. Yeah, it's such a chameleon flavor too. It kind of it blends in or it boosts up other flavors if it's got anything else to work with, rather than being a really stand up by itself kind of a flavor.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's different kind of vanilla beans out there, too. But if you're making an extract or a tincture, I do vanilla extracts almost every year. And I usually get anywhere from a quarter pound to half pound of beans a year and make extract, mostly for my family. And I've made them out of the Madagascar, which are obviously the most popular ones, the bourbon they call them bourbon vanilla beans. There's nothing bourbon about them. That just happens to be, you know, if you drink bourbon, that's the flavor of vanilla that you kind of get out of it. But you've got Ugandan, Mexican vanilla beans are best to make extract with. But, I've used, Chris, talking about cinnamon sticks. Now, I've made cinnamon extract using Saigon or Vietnamese, good Vietnamese cinnamon. Jeff, using 100, I prefer the Seagram's brand silver label 100 proof vodka. And I've made a cinnamon extract that I think you could probably control better rather than just dropping cinnamon sticks into a carboy, Jeff. I mean, that's what I'm guessing.
And the advantage of a tincture is that you do get that very fine grain amount of control. You're literally flavoring it at the end of your process rather than steeping it on the spices in secondary or something like that. So what you perceive is generally what you're going to get, except for, you know, cases like the cinnamon where it takes a little bit of time to develop in there. The other thing I should mention is, like I alluded to with that Everclear comment, the higher amount of alcohol you use in your base, the more extraction you're going to get based on that, just because that's more solute in the solution that's going to pull stuff out of there. So the 100 proof vodka will also get you more flavor out of it and give you a more concentrated flavor as opposed to the 80 proof. I don't know how much, but it's a valid point.
Now what about teas? Go ahead. You were going to finish something there.
I was just going to say, I think if you go back and listen to that episode with Ricky the Mead Maker, he alluded to brewing their ginger mead a little stronger and then diluting it to get more extraction from the ginger, just based on that the difference of like 9.5% alcohol versus 8. I could be throwing numbers up, you know, out of left field though.
Oh, you know, and I was going to say something about the almond. I made an attempt to make an almond extract, and it did not. I make all kinds of extracts with, I use that Seagram's Silver Label 100 proof vodka, and I've made orange, lemon, I mean, you name it, all kinds of extracts, and I attempted to make an almond extract at one point. Even after 6 months, it was nothing. It's not like the almond extract you get in the store. And I have no idea. I have no idea. So I don't know that you can really make an extract or a tincture out of anything. I think it's a hit or a miss.
Well, you know, the first extract that I tried with Everclear was on hazelnuts, because, oh my God, do I love me some hazelnuts.
Yeah.
I definitely got hazelnut flavor out of that. I just got a heavy alcoholic burn that I wouldn't dare put in a mead for the life of me. I got a great hazelnut flavor for my coffee for days off. I couldn't imagine going to work after drinking one of those, but...
Well, what about teas? And that's the other thing that I'm interested in, too, I love dropping a rosemary sprig into a nice bottle of Chardonnay just for a day and then pull it out. What about making teas out of, you know, different herbs and spices as well?
It's definitely a possibility, and I think the another advantage to using something like an 80 to 100 proof alcohol is that you've also got, by definition, water in there that pulls out the polar flavor compounds as well as the nonpolar ones that you need the alcohol for. That said, making a straight tea is a very valid approach. I mean, that's if you look at the hibiscus and chamomile recipe that I shared way early on in this program, that's essentially what we're doing. The brew water is just replaced by a tea made from those flowers. And you get a really strong flavor from it at the end of the whole process, just because that has infused all the water that's going into the brew. And, yeah. You know, that sprig of rosemary that you're talking about is a more subtle flavor, I would imagine. That's a perfectly valid way to do it, too. Just, you know, take a little bit to add an extra note of something interesting to kind of, you know, give it a little extra punch or something.
Yeah. And these are different ways. I mean, we're talking about incorporating different flavors into your meads using some kind of off the wall methods, really. Other than, you know, I mean, I think the typical method is to drop something in secondary, whether it's fruit or spice or what have you, and let it sit there for 6 months and hope that you're going to be able to capture that flavor. Whereas I think maybe working with a tincture or an extract or a tea almost sounds a little more exact to me. Like you can almost do it after the fact. You can put it in secondary and taste it, and you can, you know, you can gauge, you know, like you say, you can scale it. I mean, you can keep adding until you get it to the point where you like it, versus Chris is alluding to dropping cinnamon sticks into the carboy and the best. And then come to find out that one cinnamon stick per gallon, it doesn't add up when you get to 5 gallons, because now you got like fireball mead. Okay.
Well, the other place that tinctures are really attractive as a technique to adding flavor is when you're talking about adding a bunch of different flavors. If we're talking about a vanilla and cinnamon and coffee and orange mead, for example, we would want to take a different approach there, because if I were just adding an extra flavor to a mead that was already produced, it would be fine to put a cinnamon stick or two in secondary and let it sit on that. The interaction of all those flavors might change the way that I perceive it. You know, what feels like a good amount of vanilla all by itself might not feel like enough vanilla with the cinnamon and the other flavors added. Yeah. Likewise, you know, with a bunch of different other flavors added, just what seems like a good amount of cinnamon in a sweet mead might be overbearing compared to all the other flavors. So yeah. It's something where you can kind of do a taste test and do different amounts in a very small vessel before you scale it up and kind of get a ratio going that's palatable to you.
Yeah. Jeff, go ahead, Aaron.
I was just going to chime in too. Along those lines of taking this concept of making tinctures and teas and things like that on an even smaller scale, one of the things I've been thinking about is this. It's a product that I have. It's called a Randall Jr. I don't know if you guys have heard of this before. I think it's a dogfish head product that it's basically like a glass that's big enough to fit maybe a 12-ounce bottle of beer or mead with some other stuff that you could mix in there as well. So if you wanted to add some fruit or spices, or I've used it for hops in the past as well, you can kind of like steep that for an hour, for a few hours, or however long. And then at the top of it, there's like a mesh top that you can, you know, pour out just the liquid and leave all of the other sediment behind. So it's just something that I'm thinking it might be a faster alternative rather than taking a whole batch, even if it's just a 1 gallon, where you're adding a tincture or even spices directly into secondary. This is something where you can just literally take a 12-ounce bottle of mead and experiment away with it.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the like I said, the attractive part of this is that you can use very small amounts. And I don't know about all homebrew stores, but the one that I go to has a titration rod, which it essentially looks like a really big narrow eyedropper, but it's graduated so that it gives like fractions of a milliliter, really small amounts. And you could use that. I've used that in the past for dosing star sand into a gallon jug. You can use those like little fractions of a milliliter to really dial down a precise amount of flavor to go into something. You get a very high level of control there. Whereas, you know, putting a cinnamon stick in secondary is kind of like, okay, is it good today? Is it good tomorrow? Okay, how about now? And you're waiting for it to get you the result you're looking for, that you may easily overshoot it, you know, if something happens and you forget about it for a day or two.
It's kind of like the, I use the analogy, bread in the toaster on that one. Cause, you know, like you said, you drop a cinnamon stick in and, you know, in your toaster, it's bread, toast burnt. And,
yeah.
You know, yeah.
And the meat is not smart enough to shut off when it's just toast.
Right. So, it's, you know, bread, toast burnt. You've got, you know, weak, perfect overdone. You know? Exactly.
Decoction mashing. Stir, still stuck to the bottom.
I bet. What do you want to bet Chris never does another one of those decoction mashes ever again? I think that's a safe bet.
You know, the first time I did a whipped beer, I did a partial decoction, or I forget exactly what they call it, but it's a kind of a hybrid decoction. And in order to get 6 gallons with the setup I had, I actually wound up having to do three 2 gallon batches to fill up a fermenter, and froze the first two while I was waiting on the third one to get done. That was a shitty day. That was a really shitty day.
You know, one thing, Jeff, the other thing about making teas as well, and this is something Chris and I talked about, you know, working on this graph project, is you can also use, I know we're talking like Lipton's tea here, we're talking regular tea. You can use that to introduce tannins into a mead, because that's something that I have struggled with some of the stuff that I've done. It just, you know, and I think that's the part that's missing. It's that we talked about that mouthfeel last week, and how tannins can contribute to that that positive, that good mouthfeel. But you can also use teas to introduce a tannin into your mead as well.
Absolutely. Teas are a pretty good solid source of tannins. Oak is a good source of tannins. And tannins, they do overall contribute to the final presentation of that mead, the final like mouthfeel, and all those wonderful things that we're talking about. So teas are definitely a good vector for that. You can, you're not even necessarily limited to Lipton teas. One of the meads that I had worked out really well, about a year and a half ago, I made one with, it's actually a tea alternative called Honeybush. That it's not really a tea, so it doesn't actually contain caffeine, but it's brewed like a tea, and it has a tea-like quality to it that people like. And it has a kind of a, as the name implies, a slight, like, the perception of a honey character to it when you brew it. So I found that and a really light apricot flavor made a pretty nice mead.
And along this discussion about nuts that we've been talking about, if you have a mead that is really lacking in tannins, and I'm talking about severely lacking in tannins, and it's way overdone in some other area, and you need to balance that out, another good natural way to do it is acorns. Take them out of the shell and crush them up, and you can get major tannin addition through acorns. That's, if you've ever tried to eat an acorn, you know that's the reason people don't eat them, because they're so bitter with and astringent with tannin But if you've got something that, that needs a hefty dose and you don't want to add grape tannin or wine tannin or something, you can use acorns.
I have to imagine it's a little goes a long way kind of an equation, but yeah, that is a point. You know, acorns do have a lot of
tannin. It's like one or two in a big batch, and be ready to take them out. So if you had something that finished really, really sweet and you didn't want to try to blend it down or, you just wanted to try and salvage it, and you can always do that, but be careful. And the tannins, I also should mention, you got different kinds of tannin, and the tannins that are in acorns tend to be more of what I would consider coarse tannins. They're very harsh, whereas like if you use black tea, those are more of what I would call fine grain tannins, and they're a lot more gentle, and you're not as likely to overdo them.
And I think that kind of goes back to why when we use oak, we use toasted oak instead of the raw natural oak. The tannin structure of oak without that toasting would be really harsh as well. I think that's kind of along the same lines there.
Yeah, probably so.
Well, for those of you who get into making your own vanilla extract, try it with some different alcohols too. I've done one with bourbon. I've done one with Blackstrap rum, Cruzan brand. Blackstrap rum is a good one. And I use about 6 or 8 vanilla beans per pint jar, and let them sit for about at least 6 months, or longer. But, at any rate, Aaron, your dice came up with deuces, dude, and I couldn't think of a damn thing. Did you have anything on your mind?
You know, I did, actually. So, you know, I've been planning my brew list for 2017, right? And I think what we talked about was last week. What I've really got cooking here are some plans to get into some Melomels. And we talked about Kurt Stock's, what is it, Superberry Melomel, and his Blackcurrant Cherry Melomel. And I got to thinking about some of my other experience that I've had making Melomels. And, I think we've talked on the show before, for fermentation vessels, what I use is entirely glass carboys. I don't have any buckets, which I like for traditionals, but I just keep thinking back to that raspberry Melomel that I did. And after having the mead sit on those raspberries for, a few weeks in secondary, just what a nightmare it was trying to corral those little bits of raspberry out of that narrow neck at the top. And similar type of experience I had with the J-Ohm with the oranges and trying to get those back out of the carboy afterwards just wasn't very fun. So I came across a product that is available. Northern Brewer sells it, Midwest Supplies, and wanted to throw this out to the group to see if you guys have seen this before and if you have any thoughts. I can't remember if we've discussed it in the past, but it's called a Big Mouth Bubbler. They come in different materials. You can get plastic ones. I think you can get glass ones as well. But I was looking at this thing, and it seemed like maybe the best of both worlds between a bucket and a glass carboy. Because there are things about the glass that I like.
Aaron, I've got the glass Big Mouth Bubbler that's with the spigot on the bottom of it. And I love it. I've got a six. Mine is 6.5 gallons. It's glass, and then it's got that. I think they call it the no rack version or something like that. And what I love about it is I do primary fermenting in it, and then I don't even need the siphon. I put the hose on the spigot, and I put the hose into the carboy, and I go right into secondary with literally no siphoning. You just turn it to open and go right in there. I, like you, prefer glass. I mean, I know primary fermenting in plastic is perfectly fine, and Chris would tell you that, or probably will tell you that as soon as I'm done talking. But for whatever reason, I like glass, and I'll tell you that the 6.5 gallon big mouth siphonless, that's what they call it, siphonless. That 6.5 gallon glass siphonless big mouth bubbler gets its work done over here. It's rarely empty.
Interesting. And the valve, the spigot is far enough up off the bottom you don't pick up sediment or?
Yeah, I mean, if you're a miser, you're going to get a little upset because you might miss a half inch or an inch of liquid there. But
a quart.
I've never had it the other way where I've had the spigot the spigot underneath the sediment bed.
Yeah. I use plastic buckets.
Told me to say it.
We were waiting. I didn't want to disappoint you, Ryan.
This is a guy who spent $240 on a grain bill but will refuse to buy a stainless steel fermenter. So, Aaron.
No, I like glass. I like glass for secondary. I tried the plastic carboys, and every time you pick them up, you risk pulling the sanitizer through the airlock back into the bucket. And that doesn't happen with glass. So I'm all for glass with secondary. And if I could find a glass primary big enough, I'd use that too. The reason I use plastic buckets is because I've seen so many people talking about blow-off tubes. And you get an 8 gallon or a 10 gallon bucket and a 5.5 gallon primary, batch, you're not going to have to worry about a blow off tube. That's the main reason. Plus I can do a 5.5 gallon batch and put, 30 pounds of fruit in it and I got room. And I have yet to find a glass primary big enough to do that.
Yeah. Is that something you're looking at getting into, Aaron?
It is. It is. And I think the 6.5 gallon big mouth bubbler is the one I kind of have my eyes on. But now, Chris, you raise a good point about, if you're really going heavy on the fruit, which is probably what I'm looking to do here, maybe you want to go for something a little bit bigger in the plastic variety. But also at the same time, you could scale down the batch size and do maybe a 3 gallon batch or something like that as well. But yeah, it's something I'm definitely thinking. As I was kind of cruising through one of the Mead Facebook groups, and Ryan, maybe I can pick your brain on this a little bit. I forget who it was that posted this, but it was a picture of someone using one of these big mouth bubblers, and they had a couple of bricks that they had put on top of it to like weigh the top down. And I also noticed in like some of the reviews on the Northern Brewer website, it seemed like people either loved it and gave it 5 stars or they hated it. And this was the reason they dinged it, was that the lid didn't seal super well for them. So I don't know if, in your experience, is that something that you had to contend with, or how does that work?
Yeah, that is exactly, I would say, my only challenge, but it is not a severe challenge. Early in fermentation, I've had that lid. Now that lid, if it were a screw-on lid, something with a gasket that would provide an airtight seal, and you screwed it on, I don't think it'd be a problem. But it's this ribbed push-down version, and it's got 3 or 4 ribs on it, and you push it, you just push it straight down. And I've had some very vigorous fermentations that have pushed up the lid, you know, right off. And I've gone in there and it's been sitting, you know, on top of the fermenter. So, you know, number one, yeah, I absolutely have had that happen. And I would say it's a design flaw, no doubt. At the same time, yeah, I could probably put a couple of cans of soup on top of it and it wouldn't be an issue. And I really wouldn't, it wouldn't bother me so much.
They used to make them screw on the early on. They worked just like a mason jar. They had the top, you know, the flat top and then the ring. I don't know why they changed that.
Now, they do have another accessory that they call it like the depth charge. And it's this cylinder. It's a metal cylinder that's got these tiny, you know, pinhole perforations in it. And the idea is you drop this thing in for secondary with your oak or your vanilla bean or your cinnamon stick or whatever you want in there. And you're able to take those daily tastings of it. And then when it's right where you want it, you pull that out and it leaves nothing behind.
Interesting.
Now I think you could achieve the same thing by throwing those in a grain sack and you know, putting them in there and with a string around it. But
maybe a couple marbles in there to hold it down, yeah.
Yeah, that's my inner Chris Spencer coming out.
Yeah. Well, I'll go you one better, and I have not done this, and I'm not going to, but I do know a guy. you know the little torpedo-looking things that are made out of a screen that you use to keep crickets in when you go fishing? I saw a guy use that once. It's made out of a stainless steel screen, and it's just a little tube, and you put your fishing crickets in there, and he uses it for spices.
I've seen people use those for dry hopping too.
Really? I got it at the brew store, but it's this plastic. I don't even know what the hell you call it. It's got a like a plug on the top and the bottom. And the top's got a little. There's a little hole. It's got a little fishing line in it. But you pull the top plug off and you fill this thing full of wood chips or wood cubes and you put the top on it and it fits right inside a 5 gallon or a 6 gallon glass carboy. I don't know what the hell you call the damn thing, but it's got this perforated plastic, on the outside. I don't think it was meant for crickets though, Chris. But if they could get past that design flaw, but it sounds like a worthwhile investment, Aaron.
Yeah, I think so. And the idea of putting a couple cans of soup or something heavy on top if you're expecting a real vigorous fermentation. Yeah, that's not ideal. Maybe it's a little bit of a pain, but that's not necessarily a huge issue or a showstopper for me. And, as I was reading some of the other reviews, it sounds like other people have used it for the exact same purpose that I would be using it for, that for melomels where they're loading it up with, you know, loading up some meads with a bunch of fruit. It just makes it so much easier than trying to cram that fruit through that little narrow top of a regular glass carboy. So I think this may be something I invest in here for the 2017 brew list.
Tony, I know Tony Cormier, so he's listening again this week. Tony, I got your message there, bud. I have no idea what's going on with this damn Skype. I hooked it up differently this time because of the issue we had with your call last week. But I did get your call. I can't add you in, otherwise it's going to put the rest of these guys on hold. So if you're still listening, you got my message deal there. Put your phone number in there and let us give you a call and see if we can't bring you to the show. He had an experience with raspberries, he says, a couple of years ago. But if we got enough time, maybe we can get him in. But I wanted to get to Chris's brew list. Aaron, did you have anything else you wanted to talk about?
You know, the only other thing, I kind of alluded to it earlier, is that Randall Jr., with my current situation where I'm in a little bit of a brewing and mead making hiatus right now, that's something that is helping me kind of scratch that itch for experimentation. You know, with these, I do have plenty of little 12-ounce bottles of traditional mead, and it's just a good way to experiment. And, you know, while I think maybe for me the preferred way of experimenting with something like nuts or teas or things like that would be in at least a 1 gallon batch or larger, it's at least a good way to experiment with some different flavors on a little bit smaller of a scale. So that was the only other thing I was going to mention tonight.
Yeah. Cool. All right. I wanted to get over to Chris. We kind of been going through our brew list for 2017, and this isn't necessarily the stuff that we have planned. It's just, you know, stuff that we think we'd like to do. And kind of going around the table here, Chris is up next. We talked to Aaron last time, I believe. And Chris, what's on your list, dude? What do you want to do for 2017?
Well, Aaron mentioned some of Kurt Stock's recipes last week, and that's something that I had forgotten about. So I want to go back and do Kurt's multiberry again, using some new techniques, and you know, since I consider myself a better mead maker now than the last time I did it. So that's one thing I want to do. The other thing that I'm working on right now, like I said, I put this Bock beer in the fermenter today. This braggot thing has really got me wondering, what can I do with it? And you know, I've said before, I'm not really a beer drinker, but I think the braggot has got a lot of potential, and it's something that I have never messed with at all. And this is, you know, this is it. The Irish red ale that I did, it turned out good as far as a braggot. It's got some more aging, but what I'm doing now is trying out different beer styles and seeing if I can brew that beer style correctly and make it taste good, and then go back, taste them, and decide which one do I think would be the best braggot. And so that's sort of a big project for me right now, is to narrow this down as far as beers and get a really good and unique braggot out of it. I need to do another sizer, and I need to do it soon, because I'd like to have it ready for this year's holiday season. And they tend to need a little more age than Melomels or traditionals. So that's on the list, coming up soon. I've got to get, one of my sourwood meads in for Ryan and his wife. I don't have anything to send to Ryan. I now know what he likes. And he mentioned last week that he said, we're still looking for the perfect mead for my wife. I think I may be able to pull that off with with one of these sourwood traditionals, and I may end up making a pieman out of it. He said that, I think Ryan said he and his wife both liked dry Rieslings.
So, yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, so I may, I'm seriously thinking about doing a dry Riesling pieman. And the sourwood's got enough spiciness to it that I think it would go good with the Riesling. Let's see, what else do I have going on? I guess the only other thing that I've got to do is a larger batch of the Heart Murmur. I finally got that recipe nailed down. I'm happy with it. I don't think there's anything else that I can improve on it with the ingredients that I have available. So I think it's time to really go big and do a big batch of it.
That one that you can easily scale up, you think, or?
Yeah. It'll scale up easy. Well, I've already done a 6-gallon batch. So I think I'm going to try to do two 10-gallon batches, and then I won't have to make any more for a while.
Yeah.
It's cool. So much trouble to make. It's so messy and it's so involved. You really don't want to be doing it every 2 or 3 months. You want to make a big batch one time and be done for a while.
Okay, so is it worse than doing a decoction mash or?
No.
I just thought I'd throw that out there.
I'm writing a letter to my congressman and to President Trump tomorrow to see if I can get decoction mashing outlawed.
Maybe we can get him to build a wall around Germany.
Yeah.
Yes. We need to get him to build a wall around caramelized grains or something. and make the grains pay for it.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, Tony Cormier, if I said that correctly again. Remember, guys, he was on the show last week, and he tried to call tonight. I have no clue. I mean, I even tested out the calling function tonight before we went live, and it worked fine off of my home phone, but for some reason it didn't pick up Tony's call. But anyway, I was able to get a hold of Tony. Tony says he had an experience with raspberries a couple of years ago. Tony, you there?
Yeah, I'm here, and you didn't mess it up this time. You got my name right.
What, I mean, raspberries can be a pretty nasty, a nasty fruit. What was your experience with them?
Well, I had just gotten my first mini auto siphon, and I was using it, and apparently the little flap inside broke off. And it started shooting everything and everything through. And it's like, oh my God, how do I fix this? I didn't get it fixed till like 3 months later, just jiggling it in there with a wire coat hanger. but that batch of raspberry mead put me off of raspberry as the sole flavor. Permanently. I mean, I tried a bottle of Red Rock raspberry, and it tasted so much like mine that I couldn't even finish.
Just too much raspberry?
It just tasted like bentonite.
Like bentonite?
Like straight.
Oh, yeah. You know... Go ahead.
I found at another brew shop, Grape and Granary, out in Ohio. They have a little stainless steel mesh tube that will go over the end of your racking cane. So it's similar really? To your little cricket cages and stuff that you were talking about earlier.
Oh, interesting. So,
yeah, I think it was like $6 or less.
Yeah. Tell you what you can do. Go to Walmart and get a stainless steel scrub pad. They come in a pack of three, and stick that over the end of your racking cane, and you'll never have to worry about fruit pulp or anything again.
Yeah, but that's kind of difficult to shove down the neck of a, I mean, if you're going through a, like a carboy, like a 5 gallon carboy.
What? Big mouth bubbler.
I use plastic bucket. Yeah, you know, I don't, my fermenters have the little valve at the bottom, but sometimes that's just a pain in the ass. And I have been using my racking cane, and I have always been, I get my big grain bag out, my big nylon grain bag out, and I put the racking cane inside that. I shove that down into my muss very carefully, mind you. And suck it out that way into the glass carboy. I'm very interested in that. Is it a stainless steel, like a little stainless steel screen or something? Is that what?
Yes, Tony? Sir. Yeah, it's a stainless steel screen. It's about 5 or 6 inches long, and it fits pretty snugly over the end of the racking cane. I've only got it on about halfway. So that way, the end of the screen will hit the bottom of my my carboy, and I've still got about an inch of headroom over the top of the bentonite or whatever I've got in there.
Yeah, good. Okay. Very good. One thing about raspberries, I've played around with raspberries a couple of times, and I invested it. Of course, this goes back to my tomato sauce making. I got this machine that you run tomatoes through, and it takes the skin and the seeds out. And you sit there and hand crank this thing. You can buy a little motor for it, but they're not really worth the extra $40. It's a food mill. And it comes with different screens on it. It's got a berry screen that you can put on and run things like raspberries, strawberries, and it works extremely well. It pulls those little tiny little seeds out, and it basically leaves you with nothing but pulp. So I would recommend that, you know, if anybody's going to make mead with raspberries, because I know the last thing you want to do, and this goes back to probably back to Jeff, the discussion we were having on tannins. If you grind up those little seeds in the strawberries and in, well, blackberries, raspberries, that's like a crap load of tannin that you're adding, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Any fruit additions, especially the smaller berries, you want to be careful not to break up those seeds.
Yeah. Yeah, so and I've read where people have, you know, put them in food processors and, you know, to grind them all up. Like, ooh, God, I don't think I'd be doing that. But
and
the
you're
next
actually
best,
better off if you can keep them out entirely. You're better off, which is where that C-Max and EX
Blauzyme, yeah, in.
Yeah, that really comes in handy because you can pretty much strain it all out.
Yeah, yeah. Ryan, you know, we were emailing back and forth. I know Chris got involved. Did you get all your questions answered about the Lalazyme?
Yeah, I was at Midwest Supplies on, was that Saturday or Sunday, and I called JD. And JD, so I'm
and what was I doing?
JD was sitting at Total Wine, and I said, I got a question about Lalazyme.
No. Tell the whole story, dude. Come on now.
I'm trying
what
to...
What was I doing at Total Wine? What was I about to do at Total Wine?
That's what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
I called JD, and JD said, I was just about to call you. I'm trying to pick out a scotch. You know, and I said, well, I'm trying to figure out Lalazyme. So it was perfect. So he's literally standing in front of a display case of scotch.
Yep.
Asking me about, you know, Balvenie and Glenfiddich and Glenlevet and 12 year and 14 year and cask and, you know, 20 year. And And what did you pick, by the way? What did you decide to go with?
You know, Ryan, we didn't come home with anything. No, I'm going to give it some more thought. You know, I've got to think about what am I going to use it in first, because I know scotch, it's not like bourbon. I have a bottle of scotch here. I didn't know what it was, and I still don't. I haven't gotten up to go look at it. But I wanted to taste that first. And then I am definitely interested in that cask, that rum cask.
What
was it called?
It's a Balvenie 14 year. Yes. It's called Caribbean cask.
Yeah.
They take white American oak and they put rum in it. And then after it's got all that rum flavor in it, they drain the rum out and fill it up with 14-year scotch and let it sit there for a few months. And it picks up this just gorgeous, warm vanilla flavor to go along with it. Some scotch purists might not like it. They might think it's a novelty. But, look, it's made by Balvenie. It's a 14-year scotch. It's great, and it gives you a little something different, which it's one of my favorites.
Yeah. So what did you you got your Lalozyme thing all straightened out?
Yeah. So I get to Midwest Supplies and I go, I didn't see it anywhere, and I said, yeah, I'm looking for Lalozyme, and the guy goes, oh, let me go to the back and see what we got. And he comes back out, and the only Lalozyme he has is Cote de Blanc. Or something like that. It's specifically designed for white grapes.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, I'm here, you know, I'll take 1 ounce of it, or 1 gram. They sell it by the gram. And I said, I'll take a gram of it. And then the guy goes, just by the way, just so you know, this is, it's being clearanced out right now at 50 cents a gram. Why don't you give me 5 grams of it?
Yeah.
So I don't know if the Lalozyme's going to know the difference between a white grape and, you know, a pear or a peach or whatever else I'm going to use. So we're going to give it a shot, see what happens, and I'll let you guys know.
Sure.
I've never used that Blanc, but I did try the C-Max. And before that I was only using the EX, and so I started using the EX and the C-Max together, because it's sort of like pectic enzyme. You really can't overdo it, so it's not going to hurt to put both in.
Yeah.
I contacted JD about it earlier this week as well, and he told me it was at Northern Brewer. And I looked on their website, and I could not find it for the life of me.
Northern Brewer does not carry Lalozyme.
Was it Northern Brewer or More Beer? Who did I send the links to? Was that you, Ryan?
You sent me the links.
Were they More Beer or Northern Brewer? I don't remember.
They were not Northern Brewer. They were...
Had to have been More Beer then.
They were
or More Wine.
More
maybe
wine
More making. Wine.
More yeah.
winemaking.com.
Yeah. Northern Brewer does not carry Lalozyme, and Midwest Supplies, maybe they got a, you know, maybe their big warehouse has a little more than that, but the store only had that Cote de Blanc.
My apologies, Tony. If you put your email address still there, I will send I'll send that link to you as well. Morewinemaking.com, I believe, is the it's the same as More Beer, same company. I've dealt with them in the past, but if you put your email address in the in that little Facebook Messenger deal there where you caught me, then I'll be glad to forward you the email the links there that I sent to Ryan.
Okay.
with that, guys, we pretty much run the gamut here tonight. Gosh, these shows, I mean, they, you know, and I'm trying to keep these things from going longer and longer and longer, but, you know, we seem to anywhere from an hour and 35, hour and 40 minutes somewhere in there, and I think that's a good time to end. Besides, we need to leave enough stuff for next week to talk about. And don't forget, February 7th, we're going to be off for a couple of weeks. We'll be back on February 28th. I know we got a few more shows to do before we get there. Just like to keep that reminder out there in front of everybody. We do a 6-2 here at the Mead House. And like Tony tonight, if you feel like calling the show, 818-921-4680. Hell, put it on your speed dial. We'd love to hear from you. The replays always available at themeadhouse.com. They're also piled up over at iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Podcastpedia. And hey, if you don't have, if you get over to tunein.com, you can download the app over there, and you can even take the show mobile. Just do a search on tunein.com for The Mead House, and it'll take you right there. So with that, guys, what do you say? Go ahead.
If you're listening to a replay, don't call us.
Yeah, don't call us. All right, so what do you say we all come on back next week, and I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about then. So we'll see you then.